In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
A mountain man on the run from the law.
He would say, if you put me in jail, I'm not going to live.
A raging swarm of killer bees.
There's a lot of fear and a lot of hysteria.
And the terrifying trial of a colonial witch.
The crowd gasps. She's a witch! She's a witch!
Inside the walls of great institutions lie extraordinary relics, tales of intrigue and wonder, and secrets waiting to be revealed. These are the mysteries at the museum. The small town of Litchfield, Illinois, is best known as a stopover on the famous Route 66. This historic roadway was rendered obsolete when it was replaced by the Interstate Highway System. But today, motorists can still get their kicks at the Litchfield Museum and Route 66 Welcome Center. On display is a vintage gas pump, a jukebox from the early days of rock and roll, and a pristine 1951 Mercury. But perhaps no object captures the spirit of the American road better than one familiar emblem.
It's a sheet of embossed metal painted white and black. It's in the shape of a shield or a badge. It has the name of a state across the top and a large number painted below it.
According to author Ken Jennings, this iconic symbol's origins lie in a dramatic innovation conceived by an unlikely trailblazer.
This is the story of America's love affair with the open road and the brilliant idea that made the whole thing possible.
How did a revolutionary plan change American highways forever? Chicago, Illinois, 1910. Just 2 years after the first Model T rolled off the assembly line, cars are quickly becoming the country's favored form of transportation.
The automobile just took America by storm. The car was freedom. You would go wherever you want.
But the promise of freedom faces a harsh reality. Outside of urban areas, there's little to help motorists find their way.
But once you got to the city limits, all bets were off. There was no signage. There was no way to know where you were going. You would literally need written directions. You would have to say, go up this road a piece until you see the red barn. People must have got lost all the time.
But one business is determined to solve the problem. The Rand McNally Company. Rand McNally publishes its own brand of what are called photo auto guides. Books which provide photos of popular routes and intersections with visual directions.
It's essentially like Google Street View, but 100 years ago. So you drive around with a set of these pictures, you know. Okay, there's that barn in the picture. We got to turn right here, honey.
But the system is far from perfect.
Stuff would change. If somebody repaints their barn or tears down a fence, every single person who owns the book is going to get lost.
In 1916, a Rand McNally cartographer named John Garrett Brink devises what he thinks is a foolproof plan.
Brink's stroke of genius. It's this jaw-droppingly bold idea.
Brink proposes giving each county road its own unique symbol.
For example, the Egyptian Trail might be a pyramid, or the Lincoln Highway might be the letter L.
With signs posted along the road and maps to match, navigation would be easy. But before the system can work, someone must take on the arduous task of putting up all the signs.
The first highway marking is done by Brink himself. He drives around northern Illinois and southern Wisconsin, tacking the signs onto utility poles.
When Rand McNally prints maps bearing Brink's innovative symbols, they're an unqualified success.
It's a real paradigm shift for drivers. Suddenly they know exactly where they are at all times. They know which road they're on. They know what other roads branch off from it. It's a real game changer.
The plan is so effective that Brink is put in charge of a team of draftsmen who spread out across the country with a goal of labeling every single road in America.
John Brink gets a promotion. He's Rand McNally's chief highway explorer.
But by 1920, Brink's brilliant system is being undermined.
The problem for Rand McNally is that all their competitors realize this is how roadmaps are going to be. So now every publisher is doing the same thing.
Other companies create their own set of road symbols and put up their own signs. And in just a few short years, there's anarchy at every intersection.
Suddenly, you've got a bunch of competing systems. You're driving around, and now every pole you stop at, maybe it has five or six signs, and you've got to figure out which one matches the map you've got in your glove compartment.
The clutter renders Brink's idea useless and sends sales of Rand McNally guides into a tailspin.
The future of Rand McNally road mapping was really in jeopardy right here.
Can John Brink cut through the clutter and save his company? 5 years later, the federal government decides to consolidate the country's loose collection of county roads into one entity.
The government knew that if you really wanted to drive across America, there needed to be one unified system.
This is a huge opportunity. If Rand McNally can get Washington to adopt its system, they can finally leave their competitors in the dust. So they ask their star cartographer, John Brink, to make a presentation. And this time, he delivers an idea that really stands out.
John Brink and Rand McNally present a plan of numbered highways. It's easy to see at a glance. It's easy to print at a sign. It's easy to remember. Numbers seemed like the perfect way to label a highway.
Rand McNally wins the contract on the spot.
This must have been amazing for John Brink.
Teams of workers fan out across the country, pulling down scores of contradictory signs and replacing them with simple numbered road signs. Just like this Route 66 sign, now on display at the Litchfield Museum and Route 66 Welcome Center. The Rand McNally Road Atlas bearing numbered symbols becomes an instant bestseller.
Rand McNally becomes the go-to name for people to get across America. They're synonymous with the modern road trip.
And today, this iconic emblem at the Litchfield Museum and Route 66 Welcome Center is a symbol of an ingenious designer who paved the way for generations of American drivers. Oakland, California. In 1870, this city's centrally located Lake Merritt became the site of North America's very first wildlife refuge. And this spirit of preservation continues at the Oakland Museum of California. This facility showcases the diversity of the region's wildlife, with displays on peninsular bighorn sheep, an aquarium with local fish species, and a replica of a Northern Californian marine sanctuary. But amidst these sizable exhibits is one tiny specimen best examined with a magnifying glass.
It's about 2 centimeters long. It's yellow and black. It's covered in tiny hairs, and it has enormous bulging eyes on its head.
According to curator Sarah Sider, this insect sent an entire hemisphere to the brink of hysteria.
News about it caused an international panic that left scientists scrambling for answers.
How did an experiment gone wrong unleash a swarm of killer bees? 1956, Sao Paulo, Brazil. Dr. Warwick Kerr is an entomologist, an expert in the study and science of insects, who is trying to help this country jumpstart its honey industry. While the United States produces 120,000 tons of honey a year, Brazil yields a mere 6,500. And the problem lies in the types of bees that populate this South American country.
Brazilian beekeepers are using honeybees that they've imported from Europe. These bees are not adapted to the tropical climate of Brazil.
they're susceptible to diseases, and so they're not able to produce as much honey.
But Dr. Kerr thinks he can solve the problem.
He wants to help breed better bees that will help Brazilians produce more honey.
Dr. Kerr believes that crossbreeding Brazil's bees with a hardier species will yield the perfect honey-producing insect. So he imports 63 queen bees from a region of the globe known for its especially robust stock, southern Africa.
African bees are a lot more efficient at foraging for nectar, so they were so much more productive than the European bees.
Dr. Kerr brings the new arrivals to his apiary. He places them in compartments separate from the rest of the population until he's ready to begin breeding. But it's not long before human error comes into play. A fellow beekeeper mistakenly lets some of the imported bees out of their compartments, and the insects escape.
So 26 of these African bees were released into the wild, and they flew off into the Brazilian jungle. Initially, Dr. Kerr and his team weren't particularly worried. They thought they might interbreed with some wild European bees that were roaming the countryside and essentially produce the strain of bee he'd always hoped for.
But a few months later, Dr. Kerr hears something that proves his theory is incorrect.
Brazilian farmers started to notice that there were larger swarms of bees and that bees around them were more aggressive.
Dr. Kerr realizes that his imported insects are mating with other bees, creating offspring that are far more aggressive than anything Brazil has seen before. And soon, they begin to attack.
Africanized bees often become very agitated very quickly. He started to hear about reports of farm animals, cows and pigs, being stung to death after they blundered into a hive.
And livestock aren't the bees' only targets.
There started to be reports of farm workers and children that were stung to death by these really vicious bees. They can deliver 10 times the stings of a European honeybee.
The bees spread out across Brazil for years, leaving a trail of terror and fear in their wake. In 1965, the press dubs these terrorizing insects killer bees, further fanning the flames of public panic.
There's a lot of fear and a lot of hysteria.
With each passing decade, the population of killer bees skyrockets across Brazil. And soon, to the horror of many, the bees begin migrating north.
Swarms reached Venezuela in 1975, and over the next 20 years, they killed over 400 people.
Swarms of aggressive bees invade country after country until they finally make their way to Mexico. Americans can only look on in fear, realizing that swarms of these vicious insects are at their doorstep.
We know they're coming, but we're not ready for them.
Can anything stop these killer bees?
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
For decades, swarms of super aggressive honeybees have been sweeping across South and Central America, attacking livestock and people. Now, they finally arrived at the U.S. border, unleashing a wave of panic. So can anything stop these killer bees?
In 1990, the descendants of Dr. Kerr's imported bees, like this specimen at the Oakland Museum of California, finally cross the Texas border. Americans brace themselves for widespread killer bee attacks.
U.S. authorities were very concerned that Africanized swarms might enter the U.S., kill U.S. citizens, attack our livestock.
But then, something surprising happens. Far from unleashing a wave of terror across America, these killer bee attacks are few and far between. In fact, over the course of the ensuing 20 years, fewer than 12 Americans are fatally attacked.
There have been fewer deaths than expected, and it seems a lot of the media was overstating the problem.
So why did America's killer bee invasion fail to live up to its deadly hype? Many scientists believe the bees were not able to thrive in the country's cooler temperatures. Others chalk the phenomenon up to the simple passage of evolution.
Over time, the Africanized bees did interbreed with European bees, and they did become somewhat less aggressive.
Warwick Kerr never forgot the accidental role he played in a tale that gripped two continents with fear. But ironically, on some level, the bee expert's experiment was successful. Today, the less aggressive descendants of Kerr's imported bees have made Brazil the fourth largest honey producer in the world. And this preserved Africanized bee rests in the Oakland Museum of California collection. A stinging reminder of the terror inspired by the smallest of creatures. Once a key stop on the Underground Railroad, Detroit, Michigan has always been a major center for African American culture. And perhaps no institution preserves this heritage better than the Charles H. Wright Museum of African American History. Exhibits include a replica slave ship, famous Olympian Eddie Tolan's track shoes, and a version of the medical bag used by the first black female physician. But one item seems to have no obvious place in the collection.
It's made of canvas, has a pointed head, two squares that may be considered eyes, and then there's these tubes that come out the side and join together at the bottom. To look at it, you might think that it was otherworldly.
But as museum curator Petrina Chatman can attest, this strange contraption made an invaluable impact here on Earth.
This apparatus was not only important in helping to bridge the racial divide, but it was responsible for helping to save thousands of lives.
What is this bizarre piece of equipment, and how was it used in a dramatic rescue? 1912, Cleveland, Ohio. 35-year-old Garrett Morgan has arrived in this Midwestern city with dreams of becoming a successful businessman.
Garrett Morgan opened a sewing machine repair store. In those days, almost everybody had a sewing machine in their home, so he was in great demand.
Encouraged by his initial success, he looks for new ways to make his mark on the world. One day, as he returns home, he passes a building engulfed in flames.
He saw firemen running in and out, trying to fight the fire.
As he watches the chaos unfold, Morgan makes an observation that will change his destiny forever.
As a result of the smoke and noxious fumes that were emanating from the fire, they had to keep running outside to catch their breath. He was wondering what could make it easier for these men to do their jobs.
In his workshop, Morgan sets out to answer this question. He designs a canvas hood that completely covers a person's head with two tubes that hang near the ground.
He knew that oxygen stayed lower to the floor. So he came up with an idea of using tubes that could get the oxygen.
And to prevent soot and ash from entering the low-hanging opening, he devises an ingenious solution.
Garrett figured that a wet sponge inside that tube could filter out the smoke and allow the person to breathe better.
Garrett Morgan names his new device a safety hood. And to prove its value to fire departments and government officials, he travels the country performing an attention-grabbing stunt.
Garrett Morgan would put on the safety hood and go inside a tent that had all kinds of smoke. He goes in and he stays not 1, 2, 3 minutes, 5 minutes. He stays a total of 20 minutes.
Then, suddenly, Garrett emerges from the smoke, bringing the heart-stopping demonstration to a stunning conclusion.
He comes out unscathed. Now they're believers.
Morgan expects his new device will be a surefire hit, but he faces a huge hurdle.
White people weren't very excited about African-Americans doing very much of anything.
Across the country, predominantly white fire departments refuse to purchase his creation. But that summer, an incident occurs which offers Garrett an opportunity to put his safety hood to the ultimate test. On July 21st, a team of workers building a water tunnel 250 feet under the bottom of Lake Erie is caught in a devastating explosion. The blast traps more than a dozen men, and the tunnel is filled with suffocating natural gas. The deadly vapors make it impossible for rescue crews to reach survivors. But when news of the disaster reaches Garrett Morgan, he believes he is just the tool that can help. His safety hood.
Garrett Morgan got his brother, and they got some of the safety hoods, and they went to help.
But at the scene, Garrett finds the workmen reluctant to use his bizarre-looking device.
They don't trust that this thing works.
Aware that the trapped men are running out of time, Morgan makes a bold decision.
Garrett and his brother don the hoods, and they go right into the horrible situation.
Morgan and his brother descend more than 200 feet into the poisonous fumes. Thankfully, the safety hood's innovative tubes provide a vital lifeline to the pockets of oxygen that remain near the floor.
The hoods are working. They can breathe.
Then there's a sign of hope.
One man groans. They find them clinging to life.
Garrett carries the man to safety. And when he emerges from the tunnel unscathed, the once skeptical workers are amazed.
At this point, the other men were willing to assist.
Protected by Morgan's device, crew members save the lives of two workers and recover four bodies. News of the dramatic rescue and the central role played by Morgan's safety hood, like this one on display at the Wright Museum in Detroit, make headlines nationwide. And orders start flying in for Morgan's celebrated creation.
Fire departments all over the country wanted these hoods.
In 1917, when America enters World War I, soldiers in Europe find themselves under a new and dangerous threat, mustard gas. And once again, Garrett Morgan heeds the call to help, tweaking the design of his safety hood for the needs of the battlefield.
He shortened it, he refined it, and it became known as a gas mask.
Morgan's groundbreaking device saves thousands of lives during the war. And today, Garrett Morgan's safety hood sits on display at the Charles H. Wright Museum of African American History. It stands as a tribute to an ingenious man who put his own life on the line to save others, breaking racial barriers in the process and forever changing the face of emergency response. Glacier National Park spans over 1 million acres of northwestern Montana. Protected within this vast territory are dramatic waterfalls, crystal clear lakes, and over 150 mountains. And here at the park's headquarters is an institution that catalogs over a century of history, the Glacier National Park Museum and Archives. But among its historic records is one natural specimen with a distinctive man-made characteristic.
It's a little less than 2 feet in length. It's about 6 inches in diameter. It's made of wood. It's got some carving on it with initials, as well as a date.
As park ranger Denise Germain attests, this seemingly innocent carving was made by a legendary fugitive.
The man that made his mark on this object made his mark on Glacier National Park.
Who inscribed this tree bark, and how did he become one of the region's most infamous outlaws? May 11, 1910, President William H. Taft signs a bill into law placing 1,500 square miles of Montana wilderness under federal protection, officially creating Glacier National Park. To steward this new park, the government finds itself in need of individuals who are adept at traversing the mountainous terrain. And they find the perfect candidate in a rugged local outdoorsman named Joe Cosley.
Joe Cosley is a mountain man. He's a trapper. He's a hunter. He knew the backcountry like the back of his hand. They were looking for individuals that had the skills to survive in, you know, a big, vast, wild area. And Joe Cosley had those attributes.
Joe Cosley is hired as one of the park's first rangers and quickly distinguishes himself as among the best on the staff. But before long, officials notice a troubling problem with their star employee. Despite his new role, Cosley is still trapping animals and selling their pelts for large amounts of money, activities which are illegal now that this region of Montana is under the stewardship of the federal government.
He still could not give up some of his old habits. And when park administration found out about that, they fired him.
But their problems with the mountain man are just beginning. After Cosley's dismissal, the ex-ranger continues his prolific poaching. So authorities decide enough is enough and vow to have him arrested. But despite numerous attempts to track him down, rangers fail to catch the wily outlaw.
He was elusive. He could traverse the country much faster than other folks.
And everywhere he goes, Cosley leaves an unusual calling card.
Joe Cosley was known for carving into trees. And one of those tree trunks is now part of the archives collection at Glacier National Park.
For years, park rangers tracked Joe Cosley, but he seems destined to remain one step ahead of them forever. Then, on May 6, 1929, a park ranger named Joe Himes makes an unexpected discovery. He stumbles upon an empty campsite with a smoldering fire and a cache of animal pelts worth several thousand dollars. The ranger decides to wait for the poacher to return.
He staked it out for a bit and hid to be able to see what was going on.
Suddenly, Himes spots someone enter the camp, and it's none other than Joe Cosley. Himes promptly arrests the fugitive and brings him to park headquarters.
Joe Cosley was charged with poaching within the national park.
Cosley is sentenced to 90 days in jail. But as he stands before the judge, the infamous mountain man seems to be a shadow of his former self.
Cosley would say, you know, I'm sick, I'm dying on my deathbed. You know, you shouldn't do this to me. If you put me in jail, I'm not going to live.
The sympathetic judge agrees to let him go. But strangely, instead of recuperating at a nearby inn or hospital, Cosley disappears without a trace. Authorities immediately suspect that Cosley faked his illness to escape punishment for his crimes. So park ranger Joe Himes sets off for Cosley's camp, hoping to head him off and bring him back in. But he's too late.
By the time he got to the camp, everything was cleaned up.
Just a few days after his disappearance, park rangers learn of the first reported sighting of Joe Cosley. Someone fitting his description was spotted selling animal pelts nearly 200 miles away from the park headquarters.
The guy who said he was deathly ill hiked into the park pretty well.
As tales of Joe Cosley's defiant adventures spread, they resonate with many independent-minded Montanans. Locals come to regard him not as an outlaw, but as a rugged folk hero, a man who outsmarted the government to live the life he loved.
The legend and the myth of Joe Cosley is still alive in this area.
And today, this tree bark, carved by Joe Cosley himself, sits in the Glacier National Park archives in Montana, a reminder of a rogue ranger who went on to become one of the region's most legendary heroes. The city of Dublin, Ireland, was originally founded as a Viking settlement in the 9th century. And along the River Liffey, visitors can find an institution that celebrates the long and storied history of the Emerald Isle, the National Museum of Ireland. Its collection includes traditional Irish costume dresses, the first flag of the Republic, and the jacket worn by revolutionary leader Michael Collins on the day he was assassinated in 1922. But among these cherished relics is a rather pedestrian-looking object.
It's 77 centimeters in diameter. It's made from cork and from canvas, and around the back you can faintly see two words, Lusitania and Liverpool.
According to journalist Louise Holland, this artifact is one of the only surviving remnants from a catastrophe that changed the course of the 20th century.
100 years later, and we still don't know what really happened.
How is this life buoy connected to one of the greatest controversies in maritime history? New York City, May 1st, 1915. World War I is raging in Europe. But with America staying out of the conflict, for the well-heeled men and women boarding the RMS Lusitania in Manhattan, war is the farthest thing from their minds.
They were about to head off on an amazing week-long cruise, bound for Liverpool in the UK, and they were ready for a voyage of a lifetime.
The Lusitania is considered the jewel of Britain's Cunard cruise line. Just after noon, the ship sets off. It carries over 1,200 passengers and nearly 700 crew members, all under the charge of 58-year-old Captain William Turner.
Captain Turner was one of the company's most experienced seamen. And if anybody was going to take the Lusitania safely from New York to Liverpool, it was him.
With Germany and England locked in combat, the North Atlantic is teeming with U-boats. Yet the seasoned captain takes the danger in stride. Passenger ships are off limits under international laws of war. For 6 days, the cruise proceeds without incident. But on May 7th, as the Lusitania rounds the southern coast of Ireland, a lookout spots something troubling. A stream of bubbles on the water's surface, racing towards the ship.
This was the unmistakable sign of a German torpedo.
The lookout immediately raises the alarm, but it's too late. The torpedo slams into the side of the ship. Moments later, a second, much larger blast rips through the ship's hull.
There was smoke and steam. The Lusitania tipped to the right so that water was pouring in.
The ship sinks so fast that only 6 out of 48 lifeboats are launched.
If you think about the Titanic took 2.5 hours to finally sink. The Lusitania took 18 minutes.
1,193 people perish in the frigid waters. And this life buoy at the National Museum of Ireland is one of the few objects recovered from the scene.
Very little of the ship was ever seen again.
News of the disaster and the role played by the German U-boat stuns the British and Americans, who see the attack as a clear violation of international law.
It triggered outrage around the world. This was the sinking of a passenger ship.
But the German government counters that the RMS Lusitania was no innocent vessel, but a legitimate military target.
So the Germans classified the Lusitania as a warship and not a passenger ship.
As proof, the Germans point to the second explosion that rocked the Lusitania. It was caused, they say, by an explosive cargo in the ship's hold.
The Germans claimed that the ship was carrying ammunition and things to aid Britain in the war effort against Germany.
Yet the Cunard Line vehemently denies the accusation that the Lusitania carried munitions. Britain, for its part, urges the U.S. to declare war on Germany. And while President Wilson initially opts to stay out of the conflict, the fact that 128 American citizens are among the dead is impossible to ignore.
After the sinking of the Lusitania, the tide of public opinion in the US towards Germany changed dramatically.
Eventually, the continued sinking of passenger and merchant ships by the Germans forces Wilson's hand, and the US formally enters the war in 1917.
The sinking of the Lusitania was a catalyst for the US to join the Allies in World War I.
World War I ends in 1919, but the tragedy of the Lusitania remains a fierce subject of debate for years.
So many people have been so engaged by this disaster.
Following the war, documents emerged that shed new light on the incident, beginning with the logs of the German U-boat commander who ordered the attack. His diary confirms that only one torpedo was fired on the Lusitania, suggesting the secondary blast came from the ship itself. Then, decades later, declassified documents from the British archives further bolster the German case.
It said for definite there were munitions on board the Lusitania. There were a large amount of explosives and loaded shells.
For some, the revelation is proof that the Lusitania's demise was hastened by its own explosive cargo, and that, unbeknownst to its passengers, it was serving a military purpose. Still, almost exactly 100 years after the tragedy, the debate lingers on. And this life preserver at the National Museum of Ireland, one of the only surviving relics of that dreadful event, speaks to the fragility of human life and to truths that still lay buried beneath the sea. Virginia Beach's allure as a vacation destination stretches back to 1883, when rail service to the coast first brought hordes of visitors to its shorelines. But a few miles inland is an institution that offers a different slice of local history. The Ferry Plantation House. Built in 1830, this federal-style home is now a museum and educational center. Its displays include traditional oyster farming tools, a 19th-century laundry machine, and a pianoforte played by Virginia's own Thomas Jefferson. But there's one glimmering piece here that seems to outshine the rest.
It's as big as a softball, blue in color, made of glass, and it's beautiful to look at.
But according to executive director Belinda Nash, this entrancing item was once believed to have supernatural powers.
People use this in their homes to protect them against the devil.
What role did a glass orb play in a captivating case of old world witchcraft? 1706, Pungo, Virginia. Grace Sherwood is a widow and mother of three who spends most of her days toiling in the fields.
Grace was a very beautiful woman, 46 years of age, and a wonderful farmer.
But Grace's rugged individualism earns her the scorn of her fellow Pungo citizens. She bucks tradition by refusing to remarry, and despite the arduous labor, never hires help to farm her land.
That's one thing a woman would never do in that day and time, is work her own fields.
Grace also has an iconoclastic style and forgoes typical feminine fashion in favor of more practical attire.
Grace would wear her husband's breeches because it was easier to till the land.
Grace largely shrugs off such criticism.
She kept to herself and she raised her boys.
But one neighbor, a woman named Elizabeth Hill, proves impossible to ignore. Hill spreads malicious rumors that Grace does not come by her farming ability naturally.
She said she's learning to do her ways from the devil.
And one day, Hill takes her hatred for a neighbor to an explosive new level. Hill marches into a Virginia courthouse and charges Grace Sherwood with the crime of witchcraft.
Being called a witch was the worst thing that a woman could have faced at that time.
Unlike the Salem witch trials, which consumed Massachusetts with fear and sent 14 women and 5 men to the gallows in 1692, the Commonwealth of Virginia had largely avoided such mass hysteria. But even so, local law requires all claims of sorcery to be investigated. And the court takes Hill's accusation against Grace Sherwood very seriously.
The judge said, get the sheriff to search her home for works of the devil.
But when Grace's house is searched, it's not what the sheriff finds that troubles him. It's what he doesn't find. It seems Grace's residence lacks a common item found in nearly every Pungo household. A witch's ball, just like the one on display at the Ferry Plantation House.
A witch's ball hung in your window to ward off witches. If a witch were to touch this ball, she'd be left with no powers.
The townspeople believe that only a person who is a witch herself would not have one of these talismans.
This was another strike against Grace.
Grace Sherwood is arrested and taken into custody. But when her trial begins in July, it takes place not in a courtroom, but at the nearby Lynn Haven River. There, with the people of Pungo looking on, Grace is given one final chance to prove that she is not a witch by being tied up and thrown into the river. But the test has a cruel and ironic twist.
If you were to float and swim, you were definitely a witch. The only way that Grace could prove her innocence was to drown.
A bag is placed over Grace's head. Her hands are bound. Then she's rowed out into the middle of the river and dropped into the murky depths.
What is going to happen to Grace Sherwood? Will she float or will she drown?
For several moments, it looks as if Grace Sherwood has met her demise. But suddenly, the woman bursts through the surface, completely free of her restraints.
The crowd gasps. with horror. She's a witch! She's a witch!
Grace is swiftly convicted of witchcraft. Her children are sent to live with relatives, and she spends over 7 lonely years behind bars. Grace is finally released in 1714, forever bearing the scorn of her community.
She more or less kept to herself and died at the age of 80.
Grace Sherwood is remembered as the only convicted witch in Virginia history. But centuries after her death, she finally receives the justice that evaded her in life. On July 10, 2006, on the 300th anniversary of her conviction, Virginia Governor Timothy Kaine issues a formal letter exonerating Grace of all charges. Today, this blue witch's ball at the Furry Plantation House serves as a haunting reminder of a community consumed by fear and the independent woman who fell victim to a real-life witch hunt. From killer bees to a tragedy at sea, an outdoor outlaw to a heroic inventor.
I'm Don Wildman, and these are the mysteries at the museum.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.